Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there, I'm Carlin Appy, and this is the New Books in Science, Technology, and Society podcast. Thanks so much for joining us today. I just finished talking with Eben Kirksey about his new book, Emergent Ecologies. This came out with Duke University Press in 2015, and it's a really great book. It's super fascinating, and it's definitely a must-read for anybody who's interested in the field of multi-species ethnography, in ecology and its histories and presents and potential futures, in multi-species interactions and emergences, and in hope in animals and humans, in all kinds of things. So the book takes us into a series of sites in the Americas to look at spaces where multi-species relationships are coming into being, are transforming, are creating ecologies, are building on sort of ecologies of abandonment or destruction. It's a really, really fascinating walk through Costa Rica, Panama, New York City, Florida, art installations, laboratories, sort of gardens in zones of abandonment, rivers. It's a really wonderful ethnography that takes us into presents, pasts, and futures of beings finding ways to coexist. And so you'll hear a bunch about this in the moments to come. So I'll kind of quickly let you get to that. But I'll just say it's also a really beautifully written book. And it's a book that comes out of someone who is, I think, really admirably doing the work of a scholar artist. And I think this is a space that is coming into being right now for a number of people in a number of different fields who are not trying anymore to separate their work as a creator of art of various sorts, writing, visual art, sound art, performance art, and their scholarship, but are rather trying to find ways to bring them together, to speak to each other, to be a whole coherent self. And Eben is very much doing that. We had a chance to talk about his previous book, which was an edited volume that looked at a curated exhibition that did that. And this book here that we're talking about today, this monograph, is very much also coming out of that really wonderful spirit of coming together and being a whole self that's both a scholar and an artist, and using those two kinds of zones of activity to feed each other. So I'll let you get to it. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. I really appreciate the support of the channel that comes from your listening, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Eben Kirksey about his new book, Emergent Ecologies. Welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, Eben, and thanks very much for taking time out of what I know is a super busy schedule doing all kinds of awesome things to talk about the book. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So, Eben, let's start. Even though we've had a chance to talk before, let's do this again. Let's start, for listeners who haven't had a chance to hear your previous interview, by talking a little bit about how you came to the field. What brought you to this field of research?
Well, basically, when I was an undergrad, a freshman, I wanted to be a biologist when I grew up. In high school, I worked in a behavioral pharmacology lab where we were working with rats, and not so great things were happening to the rats in the lab. Giving them injections was part of my job. They had these head mounts on them. They would sometimes fall off. It was an incredibly violent situation. So I knew that I didn't want to do animal behavior work in the lab from that high school experience, but I decided that I was really interested in the field of ecology. And as a freshman, I signed up to be a research assistant, first in Costa Rica and then in Panama. And I started doing a lot of work in the forest. Hanging out with ants was my job. I learned how to identify them. And we were looking at this one particular ant, the fire ant, the little fire ant, Wasmania arapunctata, not the common one that you see in Florida, but one that's more common in agricultural plantations. But I started to question sort of the context of the research as a young kid. The work that I was doing in Panama was in the middle of what was then the canal zone under a situation of U.S. military occupation. The project that I was working on was in the indirect service of U.S. commercial interests, specifically the citrus industry. The little fire ant had become a pest in orange groves in Florida. So this project was trying to figure out, in the jargon of the day, the community regulating factors were of this fire ant. Why wasn't it a problem in Panama? And why was it an invasive species in Florida? So those personal experiences of just a little bit of disquiet with biology as it was sort of regularly functioning, and also I think a sense that the theoretical questions weren't that expansive. It seemed like the discipline was so relentlessly focused on the functional significance of things, this explanatory machine of adaptation and fitness was sort of the only kinds of theoretical questions that one might ask. I remember when I was working at the Smithsonian, one of the senior scientists there asked me if I might start to interview these ants as an ethnographer, in a sense. He knew that I was also interested in anthropology. I was taking undergraduate courses both in anthropology and biology. In a sort of naive way, he was trying to ask me how I might start to integrate those two disciplines. So I think like that question stuck with me and was part of the backdrop for what personally led me to try to explore what ethnography might do in a multi-species context. So eventually I left biology. I was going to do two honors theses as an undergrad. One I did in West Papua, my first book, Freedom and Entangled Worlds, which started out as my honors thesis from New College in Florida. But the second honors thesis was about ants, Ectotoma ruidum, this ant that does surprising forms of cooperation and sharing with strangers. And I guess I basically just sat on that project for a good 15 years. And basically that's what led to this book and led, to me working in the environmental humanities and trying to reconfigure anthropology and think about ethnographic practices as a way of using that descriptive mode of ethnography to interrogate human entanglements with other forms of life.
Cool. So we'll hear about some of these ants in the interview to come. And I also want to flag the fact that you just said anthropology, which would be a very clever pun. So I'm just going to give you credit for that and the nice unintentional or intentional pun there.
I'll trademark that.
Yeah, you can just take credit for that one. I'll give you that one. So the book that we're talking about today, Emergent Ecologies, kind of raises and asks us to ask and dwells in a number of really important and really interesting questions. And as a way to kind of lay the groundwork before I ask you how you came to this, what I want to do is just lay out some of those questions for listeners, just kind of right at the beginning. So the book asks, and this is in the words of the book, right from the introduction, how do certain plants, animals, and fungi move among worlds, navigate shifting circumstances, and find emergent opportunities? And that term emergent is going to be key here. When do new species add value to ecological associations? And when do they become irredeemably destructive? When should we let unruly forms of life run wild? And wildness is also going to be a kind of a key term here. And when should we intervene? Now, the book takes readers from Panama to New York City to Costa Rica to Florida and sort of back and forth again to speak to a handful of key questions. And I'll lay out some more questions here. And I'm not going to be done with the questions. This is just the second of the third set of questions. So hang in. Which creatures are flourishing and which are failing at the intersection of divided forces, competing political projects, and diverse market economies? Amid widespread environmental destruction, with radical changes taking place in ecosystems throughout the Americas, where can we find hope? And hope is also going to be a key term here. It also compels us to ask, and these are my words, not the words of the book, what's an ecosystem anyway? How is it? Where is it? Why is it? And what could and should it be? Okay, so Eben, what brought you to this particular project, and not just this project, but this particular shape of a book that manifests this project?
I think in a sense, it was sort of wandering through these worlds initially, again, as an undergrad, and then coming back, some 10, 15 years later as a postdoc, as an ethnographer of science, and just sort of myopically following my nose through a series of encounters, following these lines of flight, both in Central America, but then sort of expanding beyond, looking at global networks that connected these places to New York, to this out of Africa story of disease emergence, which follows all these predictable colonial tropes. I'd like to say sort of in the beginning that this notion of emergence for me is not meant to uncritically celebrate the novel, and very much the opposite. For me, emergence is about emergent diseases, the microbes that suddenly disrupt the predictable functioning of human economic systems, whether these are human pathogens or diseases that impact our crops or the animals that we depend on for meat, but also trying to think about emergent diseases that are often beyond the pale of human vision, things that are destroying worlds all around us, whether or not we have the right technologies or modes of storytelling to properly grapple with these emergent changes in worlds that are in part due to us, but also due to these wild agents that are beyond our control. So, but I think emergence also contains the promise of hope, the promise in, even as emergent forms of life are destroying worlds, creating order-destroying disasters, I think there's also emergent associations that one might point to that do give hope. So I've tried to both explore the interplay of these destructive capacities of emergent forms of life with the productive or generative or convivial things that come about with ecological emergences.
Great. So let's get right into it then. So you've already talked a little bit about these ants that brought you into the project. And in fact, in the first couple of chapters, we revisit these ants or revisit in the context of having talked about them a little bit already at the beginning of our conversation. Chapter one takes us into Barro Colorado Island in the Panama Canal, which was run by the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. Now, this chapter really interestingly juxtaposes the past and the present of the site, the historical archives of the Smithsonian, and your own research as an undergraduate research assistant in what it calls a kind of parallax effect. I love that word, parallax. And so can you start us off by bringing us into the significance of this notion of a parallax effect that sort of juxtaposes past and present? Because I think this is not just significant in terms of the work that's being done in this chapter, but then if we extend it into the future, it's potentially significant for a phenomenon that we see throughout the book. So in brief, what is a parallax effect and what's the importance of that for the work that you're trying to do here in this earliest part of the book?
Yeah, so in a visual register, parallax is what generates a sense of depth perception. So when you're moving in a train or in a car, the things that are close to you move a lot faster than the things far away. Even when you're standing still, the fact that we have two eyes in our head, brings things into relief. There's a wonderful comic book that I believe I've heard on your podcast called Unflattening, where
Nick Susanis. Yeah, he's awesome.
Nick has a great book where he's even taking us to other dimensions, asking us to think about what if you had eight eyes and you're a spider? What's the parallax effect there? It's not just a doubling, but it's seeing double and then some, in his words. Ellen Strain, in the Panamanian context, has talked about these stereoscopic viewing scopes that people were distributed in the early 20th century, when the Panama Canal was this grand engineering project that was linking the Americas, back in the day when you couldn't hop on an airplane and instantly get from, California to New York. The Panama Canal was this central architecture of empire, and the way that one could experience it was with these two images that were taken from slightly different angles that would bring the sort of ginormous machinery that were used to build these canal locks into relief. So Ellen Strain has written about that, both in that specific historical moment, but also, building on her, what I've tried to do is do these fast moves through time to think about things like what is the legacy of apartheid that is in existence at in a place that was formerly called the Panama Canal Zone, now is called the Reverted Zone. So in the architecture of this place, you have buildings that were created by the U.S. government from a much earlier era, where relationships between different kinds of people were naturalized. There were separate entrances for the employees who were earning the gold wage and the employees that were earning the silver wage. Panamanians, often Afro-Caribbeans, you couldn't enter the Panama Canal Zone without a special pass in those days. The U.S. military left in December of 1999, and sovereignty over this space reverted to Panama. Now these same buildings have been taken over by enterprising mestizo intellectuals, by indigenous Kuna from the Caribbean coast, by Afro-Caribbean communities, and I'm interested in how legacies are persisting over time. So doing moves that historians would maybe be outraged by, sort of slipping between the 1930s and 1999, slipping between 1999 and 2014, trying to bring into relief persistent legacies, very much trying to be attentive to how particular historical events and moments generated ruptures and emergent possibilities, but also attending to those continuities, those legacies of empire, those legacies of racial segregation that last into the present.
So I'm a historian, and I'm not outraged. Officially. So you officially are okay there with
Great.
Historians. Well, yeah.
I'll tell all the historians. That
tell
I have
all it. The historians. You got a pass. So chapter one. So thank you so much. And chapter one kind of introduces the study of these ant populations that then continues as you revisit them in the next chapter. So the ants that you studied as an undergraduate research assistant in the zone in chapter one come back up again. And in chapter two, you returned to Panama as a postdoctoral fellow in 2008 and returned to work on these ants, Ectotoma ruidum. Ruidum? Ruidum?
Ruidum, yeah, you got it.
Ectotoma ruidum. Now here, you describe the ants as having become ontological amphibians. This is a really key notion, really, for the entire book, and I think the work the book is doing. So can you talk to us a little bit about these ants and the ways that, for you, they embody what you're calling ontological amphibians?
So Peter Sloterdijk, this German philosopher who styles himself as the second coming of Martin Heidegger, has built on Heidegger to articulate this strange theory of human exceptionalism. So Heidegger famously argued that the stone is worldless, the animal is poor in world, and the human is world-forming. Sloterdijk says that the human is amphibious. So if a literal amphibian, a frog or a salamander, is choosing to live in air or water, he says that the human is choosing amongst worlds, choosing amongst ontologies. And what I've tried to do in this book is look at other species of ontological amphibians. So Sloterdijk says that the animal is trapped in the umwelt, what he characterizes as an ontological cage. If you go back and read the original, Jakob von Uxkull's account of the umwelt, I really don't think he sees the human as being exceptional. And Agamben, I think, has the clearest reading of that. And sort of, you know, in the original von Uxkull article, you see that the human has these prosthetics like telescopes. You see the girl wandering in the forest has a different vision of a tree than the woodsman. So what I've tried to do is in this book, in part, to get beyond language like invasive species, to think about other organisms that are exceptional in similar sorts of ways as the human. So these ontological amphibians, there's multiple species of them that populate the book, are ever wandering amongst worlds and forming them in a convivial alliance with others. So one of these organisms is Ectotoma, my favorite ant, and I love saying that, my favorite ant. My human ants haven't caught on to that yet, but maybe they will soon. other ontological amphibians that I describe in the book are this fungus, Bacococytrium dendrobatidis. It's a kind of chytrid that is rapidly destroying the worlds of literal amphibians. So frogs and salamanders are going extinct because this microbial fungus is destroying their worlds. And then I also talk about some plants, cattails, for example, or this really interesting grass called Hyperinia rufa. Hyperinia rufa doesn't have rhizomes. The underground stems that sort of burrow under the soil that have been used as this figure of evasion and burrowing and resistance and emergence by Deleuze and Guattari. So this plant, Hyperinia rufa, doesn't have that in a literal sense in terms of like this morphological structure under the soil, but it has what they might call animal rhizomes. This grass has these seeds with these long flagella-like things on them. So the seeds fall from the plant. They basically scurry through the forest. This flagella-like thing writhes and contracts when you get different barometric pressures and humidity levels that come into play. The plant sprouts, and then it's very flammable. So this particular ontological amphibian, Hyperinia rufa, this grass with animal rhizomes, helped cattle and capitalism and cowboys invade the dry forests of Central America. It became a companion in killing. By catching fire, it helped destroy this world, this forest that proved otherwise pretty impenetrable to the cowboys and the cattle.
Mm-hmm. And that grass, I think, is something that comes up in Chapter 9, yeah? Mm-hmm. So we'll get to that as well. So these ontological amphibians, you take us into these ants. There's this wonderful moment just to kind of name check another STS scholar whose work I really adore, Natasha Myers. And you have this moment where you take us into a kind of embodied experience a la Natasha Myers of doing what we can to try to kind of experience the sensory world of these ants. Now, these ants are doing something really interesting here called trophallaxis, okay? And you bring us into the importance of this kind of fluid exchange in the social world of these ants as a way of raising the question, are these ants capable of caring for other beings? Are they capable of this kind of altruism? Did you want to speak to that at all? Because it seems like a pretty important point here.
Yeah, so trophallaxis means nourishment interchange, and this is a word that was coined by William Morton Wheeler, the grand old man of ants, before E.O. Wilson became the grand old man of ants. And probably many of your listeners know of E.O. Wilson's sociobiology. And what I try to do is read deeply within the myrmecological literature, going back and looking at some of the early theoretical sources that people like Wheeler were drawing on, drawing in part on Charlotte Slay's work. She's got a remarkable book called Six Legs Better that chronicles the intellectual history of myrmecology. So if you page back to Wheeler's original thinking, you find that he seized on this Italian theorist, Pareto. And early in life, Pareto was concerned with the economics of rationality. And this is sort of the economics that a lot of behavioral biology is based on. A lot of assumptions aren't anthropomorphic. You know, often scholars of multi-species studies confront challenges from conventional ecologists or animal behaviorists that were imposing human assumptions on these forms of life. But I think a lot of these assumptions that they impose are mechanomorphic, assuming that ants and other sorts of animals are like machines or like robots and making these very rational calculator kind of decisions. But what we found in actually doing observations of these ants. So what I was trying to do here initially was just straight up ethnography of science. So I showed up in Panama wanting to interview people, you know, having this experience as an undergrad that gave me a little bit of insight into this social world of tropical biology. But very quickly, I found that the people in the social world didn't really want to have an anthropologist showing up, just putting a microphone in their face, doing interviews. So I adopted an experimental practice, in part as this ethnographic tactic to inhabit the lab in a different sort of way. So I actually started to design and implement my own biobehavioral experiments with ectotoma, exploring this idea of trophallaxis. So again, this word trophallaxis, nourishment interchange, in short means the exchange of liquid food from one adult ant to another. In a lot of species, they'll keep this liquid down in a specialized organ inside of their body. But with this particular ant, Ectotoma, it will carry drops of liquid around in its mandibles. So the general thought, if you page forward from Wheeler to E.O. Wilson, is that the ant colony is a superorganism where the adult animal is the rough equivalent to a cell in a multicellular organism. But if you use that metaphor in the case of this ant, Ectotoma, the cells are kind of running wild. They don't stay put within one colony, and they're one of the most prolific ants in Panama. In old growth forest, you find probably about 2 or 3 nests in a square meter. They're also flourishing within the abandoned architecture of empire. So you find them in this remarkable place called the City of Knowledge. This place with close cropped lawns that has all these abandoned satellite dishes and infrastructure from the U.S. military. This is the former command and control center for the U.S. Southern Command. So these ants are flourishing in worlds that have been there a long time, but also these emergent worlds that humans have shaped and transformed. They're very clever at figuring out the light and dark cycles that are associated with electric lights. So many of these ants, which in an old growth forest would be strictly diurnal, coming out in the day, have figured out that they can get the most insects if they come out at night when the electric lights are on. So we were interested in how these ants share food. So again, this word trophallaxis, nourishment interchange, for Wheeler, the grand old man of ant biology back in the day, that was what held the colony together. By exchanging food, that's sort of what formed the colony. We basically found in doing this biobehavioral experiment, which initially was this ethnographic tactic, a way of inhabiting the lab, but then later, after the book has come out, has turned into an actual scientific study. So we've done this experiment over and over again and come up with p-values and statistical significance, which is what the storytelling conventions of science demands, this other knowledge practice that that we've subsequently sort of inhabited. And when I say we, I'm referring to Bill Weislow, my senior mentor at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, as well as Santiago Menses, who is our research collaborator, an undergraduate student from Columbia who's going on to pursue a PhD in ectotoma studies. So to make a very long story short, to get to the punchline, basically ectotoma shares with strangers, and it will share with members of a other colony that's right next door. It'll share with members of a colony that's 15 miles away. And we found that they're not rational little calculators doing the work of reciprocal altruism, paying attention to who gives a gift on Monday and only reciprocating when those gifts are given in a symmetrical sort of way. But we found that the default mode is sharing. We'll share with pretty much anybody. And we also found that sharing breaks down when they're hungry. If the ant colony is, if you keep food away from the ant colony for a day or two, we find that sharing stops. So we did this experiment that sort of gets at some of the fundamental thoughts about social life for insects and offers, you know, a different sort of interpretation.
Awesome. Now, you just mentioned a little bit ago the City of Knowledge, right? This sort of place that was formerly Fort Clayton. This is the focus of Chapter 3. It's a really fascinating space, and it doesn't just include these ants that you were talking about. You also bring us into the importance of frogs here, and not just frogs, but chemical weapons and unexploded bombs. Can you talk a little bit about the latter? What are unexploded bombs doing in this story?
Yeah, first of all, the City of Knowledge is a place where Michel Foucault would have had a field day, not just for the name, but sort of the way that governmentality works there. So in this place where, it used to be this command and control headquarters for the U.S. military, now that the U.S. government has retracted, what you see is a lot of these international organizations like the Red Cross, like the Nature Conservancy. You see a lot of pharmaceutical trials being done by U.S. universities. So this space that was once sort of a integral node in the U.S. political project in the Americas, but also I think you must see this as a critical node connecting the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean, a really key geostrategic point for the U.S. Military. Now that it's been taken over by a Panamanian national government, you see this proliferation of institutions of governmentality that are doing similar sorts of work, but in a more distributed sort of way. So in this place, right beyond the fence, right beyond these suburban lawns, where you see caimans basking in the sun, where you see agoutis, these small little rodents foraging for nuts, where you see ectotoma, my favorite ant, proliferating amidst all sorts of strange chemical ecologies. Just past that fence, you have abandoned bombing ranges. So at the point when the U.S. military withdrew, the Panamanian government wanted the U.S. military to clean up their mess. They left behind in each one of these five bombing ranges about 60,000 unexploded bombs and chemical weapons. At that point, the U.S. government said, no, we don't have the funds to clean it up. And interestingly, the Nature Conservancy weighed in and basically said that the ecosystem would be better off if these bombs were left there. It sounds in some ways like a really cynical thing for this environmental organization to say that. And in fact, they were doing a contract for the Pentagon. But I've actually come to think of these bombs and unexploded weapons as figures of hope, sort of using the notion of the pharmacon, that dates back to Plato. And you see in Derrida, and most recently in Isabel Stenger's work, to think about the poisonous substance that in the right dose might become the cure. So these bombs usually function as these protective talismans that keep people out, that keep capitalism out of these multi-species communities. But then sometimes they violently cause pain and death. They explode sometimes. So the pharmacon has unstable properties. And I came to think about them not only as figures of hope, like very ambivalent figures of hope, but also as rivets that function to hold ecosystems into place. So in the introduction of the book, I describe this old metaphor from Ehrlich and Ehrlich in the 80s. They talked about ecosystems as having these functional parts. They said that if you walked onto an airplane and you saw somebody on the wing popping out rivets that held the wing in place, you should be afraid to fly on that partially disassembled flying machine. But what I've found, not only with these bombs, but the addition of species to ecological communities, that it's not just things that are missing that are there, but there's new things holding systems into place. So they compared Ehrlich and Ehrlich these rivets to species, and they said that every time a species goes extinct, that's an ecosystem losing an essential part. But I actually didn't find essential parts in these disaster zones, in places like these bombing ranges in Panama, in places where cattle and capitalism came in to level places. I found not a predictable process of succession, where the same community that was there a long time ago has reemerged, but I found communities that were contingent assemblages that have come together at the intersection of empire and capital and all these oblique powers. New modes of flourishing sometimes things are lost, sometimes things are gained. So really, again, I see these rivets in an ambivalent way, but, you know, embracing the pharmacological properties of hope, maybe. You know, when you hope for something and it arrives, often that moment of arrival is a profound disappointment. When you're hoping for something that doesn't arrive, that's disappointing too. So I'm trying to chart the play of hope in this book and look for figures like those bombs that anchor hope.
Thank you so much. So not just bombs, right, are figures that anchor hope, but also you talk a lot about the importance of frogs in that chapter. And frogs will continue to follow us through the story. And let's follow them as they follow through some of these chapters. Now, in chapter 4, you talk about a project caring for frogs at EVAC, okay, which is a kind of amphibian conservation center. And you bring us into the work of Heidi Ross and Edgardo Griffith in their efforts to protect frogs from a very particular kind of pathogenic fungus. This is the chytrid fungus that you, I think, mentioned a little bit earlier in our conversation. Now, you also hear, and this is something that recurs in a lot of the chapters in a way that I think is really, really fascinating, you talk about your own experience working through these issues, and your own experience specifically volunteering time to care for frogs that had gone extinct in the wild. And you talk about participant observation both at the amphibian ark in Panama and also at the Bronx Zoo in New York City. But one really interesting example here emerges, and this is something that is a kind of work that we, I think, had a chance to talk about previously and that we will definitely have a chance to talk about again in later chapters. And this is your work through creating a kind of art installation. Can you tell us a little bit about the Utopia for the Golden Frog? For listeners who are not familiar with this work and haven't had a chance yet to read the book, what is the Utopia for the Golden Frog, and what's its significance in terms of what you want to leave us with in this part of the book and in this chapter?
So basically, that disease you mentioned, the chytrid fungus, has pushed the Panamanian golden frog to the brink of extinction in Panama. So there are people like Heidi and Edgardo who are working there in Panama to create a bubble of happiness, if you will, for these frogs. They've built up this facility that is biosecure. It keeps the fungus out. They treat all the frogs that come in with Lamisil, which, you know, this antifungal cream you can buy off the shelf, and they basically kept them in this facility and are trying to imagine a future where they might escape once again, where they might throw open the hatches and let these frogs run wild. The problem is that in the wild, the fungus is still there. If they were let out, they would likely die again. A backdrop or sort of a parallel to what's going on in Panama is what's happening in the U.S. with this species. So the U.S. government ended the military occupation in Panama December 1st, 1999. Again, amidst much violence, you know, in 1989, There was this massive assault on the people of Panama. Experimental weapons were used. Lots of people killed. Poor neighborhoods bombed. There's a long legacy of U.S. unilateral intervention that makes a lot of people in Panama suspicious of any sort of regime to manage life and death. So the U.S. government gave a permit to the Baltimore Zoo and Aquarium to import the Panamanian golden frog under international law. The CITES treaty, you need these documents to move endangered species across borders. In giving this permit, they granted ownership of an entire species to the Maryland, the Baltimore Zoo and Aquarium in Maryland. And the zoo basically manages the life of the species in accordance with centralized biopolitical regimes. There's someone who basically takes note of every birth and every death of these frogs in captivity. So when these frogs initially arrived in Baltimore, they bred and everyone was super excited. They produced about 2,000 babies. Very quickly, they ran out of space in Baltimore and they started shipping them to other zoos. So now you can find Panamanian golden frogs in the Houston Zoo or the San Diego Zoo or places like Disney World. When the zoological community ran out of space, instead of sending these frogs back to Panama, they started euthanizing them. So now every time a Panamanian golden frog has a clutch of babies, again, about 2,000 of them are born, they let the tadpoles hatch and they let the tadpoles turn into frogs, undergo metamorphosis. They let the babies get a little bigger until they're subadults. And then they select 60 of those animals to live, and then they euthanize the rest. So the Utopia for the Golden Frog of Panama, the title of this artwork that I created, is something of an ironic joke. It's a living ecosystem that we installed inside of a refrigerator. And if you're a frog, probably living inside of a refrigerator is not a very utopic place to be. But what we did is create the conditions of bare life for this frog. We installed plant life, a multi-species community that would be good to live with. We seeded it with fruit flies, a mutant strain that people are using in the zoos to feed the frogs. They're mutants that don't fly and they're easier to feed to the frogs, and they don't get out as much. So after creating this sort of utopia in a fridge, we took a Arduino, this little computer chip that you can put onto various things. So we took over the temperature and humidity of the fridge. We let the Arduino control the light dark cycles in a 24-hour cycle and kept the temperature regime within what the ideal range for the species is. We installed it in a gallery in New York where there wasn't air conditioning in the summer, where it would have been too hot to keep these frogs. And then we posted our readings up to the internet. We tried to show to the world that we had indeed created, you know, this place where they could live. We put a webcam inside to let people see what it looked like. And then I started petitioning the people in the zoological community who owned the species to see if they would send us some instead of euthanizing them. In short, our project failed. We failed to actually get frogs, but I think it was ethnographically successful. George Marcus describes what he calls para-ethnographic objects, basically things that are conversation pieces. So I sort of learned as much as I could about the Panamanian golden frog to a point, and you know, interviewed people about it, but only in actually applying for permission to get these frogs did I really learn the nuanced intricacies of the legal regimes that are governing the life and death of this frog. So we were doing an act of what Beatrice da Costa would call tactical biopolitics, not just critiquing how life and death are managed, but creating this concrete proposal for managing life and death differently.
Now, how did these concerns, or perhaps related concerns, play out in another performative experiment that you talk about in the book? And this is in Chapter 6, also involving frogs, but here Xenopus frogs. And this is an experiment where you and an interdisciplinary group offered free pregnancy tests for humans and free fungus tests for frogs. This is another really interesting kind of performative experiment that speaks to and informs a lot of the concerns in the book. So can you talk a little bit about that for listeners?
Yeah, so the term performative experiment comes from Delia Hanna, a philosopher at Columbia, who got her PhD from Columbia, who was a collaborator of mine in this project. My other collaborators include Charlie Nichols, as well as Lisa Jean Moore, and the digital media artist Grayson Earle. And basically what we were trying to do is unpack the implosion histories that have coalesced around this pregnancy test. So for starters, this pregnancy test has been implicated in an out-of-Africa story of disease emergence. And like other out-of-Africa stories or contagion narratives, it had all sorts of problematic colonial tropes. You know, Africa, the diseased continent, outbreak narratives have conventionally stigmatized different groups of people and lifestyles. In this case, it was stigmatizing a particular frog, Xenopus. So there actually is empirical basis for this outbreak narrative. Xenopus frogs can carry the chytrid fungus, the one that's driving other frogs to the brink of extinction and actually causing extinctions. So they can basically harbor the disease while not being sick themselves. This trait, the ability to survive the disease, led some journalists to brand the frog as the Typhoid Mary of amphibians. So Typhoid Mary was a woman who cooked for rich people, who had typhoid, who didn't have symptoms of typhoid, but a bunch of rich people in New York City started dying of typhoid, and they identified her as the source. They basically incarcerated her, and I think there's a way. We were basically trying to explore ways of caring for this frog, Xenopus, while also caring for the worlds of frogs that are endangered by its mode of existence. It turns out Xenopus isn't alone in carrying this fungus around the world. And if you look at the genetics of the fungus itself, it has multiple origins. It doesn't have a very clear origin in Africa. It's been in Asia for at least 100 years. There's specific strains in Brazil that people find with very old and very distinct lineages. Probably what's happened is that diverse market economies and biotech schemes have brought different strains of chytrid fungi together, where they've had what the literature terms parasexual events. So this kind of fungus doesn't have straight up heteronormative style sex. Sometimes these spores will insist next to each other. And its normal mode of reproduction is clonal. So microbes making copies of microbes making copies of microbes. So sometimes that copying goes a little bit wrong and you end up with a chytrid that has twice as many chromosomes or maybe one less, or things get weird in chytrid reproduction. But also you can have these parasexual events where two spores insist next to each other, and then these root-like structures called rhizoids touch each other and exchange genetic elements. So quite probably what has happened is that the biotech biomaterials marketplace and also the food marketplace, these microbes are transported around in crayfish as well as bullfrogs, specialty food items used by people throughout the southern United States. Also, Asian markets often have live bullfrogs, and there's this very vibrant global trade. So basically, we were trying to diagnose some problems with the circulation of these forms of life and these global assemblages, and basically found that the velocity of these markets was so overwhelming. It wasn't just frogs moving around Xenopus, this out of Africa story, but all sorts of other things. So back to the other part of this performative experiment, the fact that these frogs were used in pregnancy and offering the free pregnancy tests in galleries was sort of another dimension to the project. And we've actually co-authored a piece that's forthcoming in the journal in Environmental Humanities next month that deals with sort of the queer reproductive politics embedded in this experiment. Basically, we're trying to unravel the ontological choreography of pregnancy and experiment with ways of configuring ontologies differently, playing with abilities to choose, whether that's gametes from a sperm bank, this queer marketplace that adds value to genetic material based on social worlds that value certain traits, but also the ability to choose different temporalities of pregnancy, to choose different technologies that might might destabilize conventional modes of composing a life in the contemporary era.
Great. Now, Evan, great. There's so much in the book that that we haven't had a chance to talk about that I'd love to get to. But what I want to do is take us into two moments that I think in the chapters to come highlight just a couple of really important points that are happening here, and then listeners can hopefully become readers and explore the rest. The first moment I want to ask you to talk a little bit about is a moment that moves us from frogs to macaques. And in chapter 7, you talk about a rhesus macaque who ran around Florida in 2009 and became known as the mystery monkey of Tampa Bay. So I love this moment, right? This also brings us back to Florida, which is the place that you were born, right? You say in the book.
Yeah.
You talk in this chapter about forming an interdisciplinary team to study other rhesus macaques. And this becomes a really interesting way to think about a key term that came up right at the beginning of our conversation. And that really forms the heart of at least some of what's going on here. And that's wildness. So can you talk a little bit for us about how your experience in this case might help speak to and inform and perhaps trouble what we think of when we think about wildness?
Yeah, so in part, I'm departing from Sarah Franklin's notion of the new wild. So she contrasts earlier visions of wildness, where you had domestic geese opposed to wild geese, or domestic hogs opposed to wild boar, with the new sort of wildness that is emerging within realms of biotechnology. So I think the Kittredge story that I just told embodies that notion of wildness. I'm also trying to think about this mode of wildness that is emerging unintentionally from various human dreams and schemes. So this story in Florida, and by the way, if anyone's Facebook friends with me, I was just there for spring break and had some wild encounters on the Silver River. You can see all these monkey pictures that I just took. So the monkeys are still there and they're flourishing. But they're part of this story in Florida, where basically if you go there and you go to the Silver River, and it's a great Florida vacation. It's better than Disney World. It's better than Daytona Beach. You can go on these glass bottom boat tours, and the tour boat captain will tell you the story about Tarzan and about how Tarzan was filmed on the Silver River with Johnny Weissmuller, and these monkeys, extras in the film, escaped and have proliferated. It turns out that if you actually watch all the Johnny Weissmuller films with Tarzan, you never see a single rhesus macaque. Cheetah the chimpanzee is a very different organism from the rhesus macaque. But the actual story is sort of more comical and interesting. A guy who went by the name of Colonel Tui, and that was his first name, not a military title, actually purchased these monkeys from a carnival sideshow in Albany, New York. And he outfitted this island that he created in the Silver River with all sorts of monkey swings and little houses for them to stay in. But he didn't realize when he put them there, he let six monkeys go, that rhesus macaques are very capable swimmers. So they swam away the very same day that he released them, and have been very fruitful and multiplied. And now within this area, Silver River State Park, there's at least 180. During my trip a couple weeks ago, I encountered a couple of other troops that are outside of the park. They're going wild. They've been sighted all over the state. Rumors are that a troop of macaques is approaching the Georgia border, at least as of last year. So I used this extended study of the macaques, and I did the research in collaboration with Aaron Riley, who's an ethnoprimatologist at San Diego, her graduate student Tiffany Wade, as well as Elon Abril, a PhD candidate at the CUNY Graduate Center, who is finishing up next week and defending. And what we were trying to do is both characterize the affect that is at play in these encounters, how affects can leap from body to body in these encounters that become intense. So thinking about wildness in these moments where people are using the monkeys as mirrors and windows into their own imagined primate nature, but also how violent some of these encounters can get, and how there's an asymmetrical risk and vulnerability at play in these worlds. And here we're building very much on the work of Juno Pereñas, who's studied similar dynamics in Southeast Asia with orangutans, to think about how asymmetrical risks are at play when species meet. So the people who encounter these monkeys are on boats. They're often tossing food at them, making chimpanzee sounds, and joking with each other. But the patterns that they feed the monkeys in very much determine what kinds of interactions unfold. So through Aaron Riley, I learned about the very complicated dominance hierarchies that are at play in macaque social worlds. It used to be thought that the alpha male was the one who called the shots, but it turns out that his presence in the troop is only contingent on whether or not the women in the troop, a coalition of elder females, sort of determines which males they want to let hang around. So that monkey is very visible. The alpha male, which got named by Bob Godshock, a citizen scientist who worked with us on the river. So you'll see the alpha male up front, but you also see the alpha female. And the really interesting thing about macaque dominance hierarchies is that the third monkey in line to get food is the alpha female's youngest daughter. People want to feed the babies when they're there, so they're often throwing food to the young, cute-looking monkeys, and that is a situation that produces conflict. Some people are deliberately trying to produce conflict, and these interactions where people are feeding the monkeys are often drawing them down towards the river, where they become vulnerable to attack by alligators. So basically, we found that sometimes feeding produced violence within the macaque social world, but the humans were relatively safe in the encounter. In a sense, the stories that we told, we learned about some incidents where monkeys did actually get eaten by alligators, got eaten by hawks. Most of the encounters ended happily, in the sense that there wasn't a severe injury to any of the monkeys while we were doing the work, but we were trying to attend to wildness in its capacity to spin out of control and its capacity to make vulnerable members of a social world more vulnerable. And also the ways that, things are running wild on unpredictable lines of flight that are escaping any ability of people in the current era to manage and control. So we try to interrupt some of the conventional ways of thinking and speaking about invasive species in this chapter as well. When you start killing plants that aren't perceived as belonging in a particular place, people aren't thinking about the subjectivity and experience of the actual organism. I think when you're confronting the presence of primates in a space where conventional logic says that they don't belong, you have to think about a whole host of other questions.
This actually really beautifully brings me to the other thing that I wanted to ask you about. Right? So there are other chapters here that we won't have a chance to talk about that we'll kind of skip over on the way. There's a really wonderful chapter here, chapter 8, that looks at multi-species households in Florida, takes us into pythons and birds that live with and sort of have relationships with people. There's also a really interesting chapter that takes us into Palo Verde National Park as what you call an emergent agro-industrial ecosystem. And this is where that grass with the cowboys and the cattle comes up that you mentioned a little bit earlier. But what I want to do is take us into the end of the book. And this is a way that chapter 10 kind of segues into the conclusion. In chapter 10, you take us into a place called Monteverde Cloud Forest School. Now, this is a really interesting space where, as you show here, there are people making decisions in caring for what's an emergent forest here about which species to nurture and which species to kill. So you can sort of hear how this comes from what you were actually just talking about. Now, this issue of how to care in this dynamic that involves having to make a choice about what to nurture and what to kill, this is very much something that comes up in the conclusion. The conclusion asks what seems to me to be a central question, both for the book and beyond, and I'd like to ask you to speak to it as we kind of move to our conclusion as a way perhaps of wrapping up. Here's the question that it poses. How should we love in a time of extinction? You talk about here the importance of, in the words of the book, love in ecological communities means living with the necessary labor of killing. So, Evan, as a way of kind of maybe bringing us to a conclusion, can you talk about this? How should we love in a time of extinction?
So the final chapter of the book focuses on the work of Milton Brennus, a Costa Rican farmer, an organic intellectual who is literally gardening in the ruins. He's gardening in the ruins of cattle and capitalism and caring for particular plants and animals in these multi-species worlds. So care in this context, as you said, involves this labor of love, but also this labor of death and killing. So choosing to love one species in these multi-species assemblages involves figuring out how to kill the enemies and cultivate the allies of that particular plant or animal that you happen to love. So making that distinction is a very high stakes and potentially arbitrary distinction, you know, who to love and who to kill. So Milton basically answered that question in terms of situated effect and action rather than categorical distinctions like native and alien. He found that actually earthworms, undocumented laborers rumored to have come from California, were key to enabling a multi-species flourishing in this blasted landscape. So basically the Cloud Forest School inherited this land that had been trampled by cattle, that had been compacted. The soil was like concrete. It was lifeless. And Milton basically used detritus that he collected from the lunch of school children who were going to the school, as well as the actual food and then the milk cartons to create these little bits of compost. So he would germinate seeds. He figured out how to care for each different kind of seed to kill the parasites that were often lurking on the seeds. And then he planted them each in these tiny little bits of compost. And those balls of compost helped the seedlings get a foothold in the rhizosphere. So the rhizosphere is the area of the soil that's around plant roots. So the area where he was working was covered by this African grass, star grass, a different grass from the ones that people were contending with in the lowlands of Costa Rica with that those animal rhizomes that are spreading. This grass had both literal rhizomes and the ability to sort of climb up in these huge bushes that overshadowed other forms of life, that created these dense stands that were impenetrable to people. And it also didn't give other plants a lot of opportunity to germinate. So his key enemy in this reforestation project was that star grass. He tried to figure out all sorts of innovative ways of killing. He found that if he went in with weed whackers or machetes, that it would quickly resprout, convincing his colleagues. He heads up the maintenance department, and it's very difficult labor to work with a machete and kill this plant. So he figured out a way of killing that channeled death back into life rather than just chopping up the grass, leaving it for dead where rhizomes can re-sprout. He figured out that actually bringing alien animals into the space again, horses and cattle in low numbers, they became companions in killing that allowed for a convivial emergence of plants and animals that he cared about. So some plants that emerged that were not actively planted in this reforestation program proved to be allies to Milton's project. One was an aster, a bush that they simply called monte, a word that means weed. They found that monte stands facilitated the growth of other native plants. Monte is this weed that just spreads out, sends thousands of seeds out at once. But these carpeted stands of monte quickly had other trees emerging within them. Fiddlewood was one. And Milton was basically caring for species that were convivial. He planted a lot of Inga punctatum, a plant that's known as ice cream bean in English. It was one of the favorite recess snacks of the kids, and it also is a favorite food of monkeys and toucans. He was trying to enlist multiple species and multiple social worlds in this forest, rather than create a place that was outside of culture, outside of relations of use, he was trying to interest the children in particular plants, showing them which ones were valuable timber species, which ones would attract pigs, which are valuable game animals. But in addition to attracting these human social worlds, people who would care for this forest on into the future, he also tried to enlist frugivores, animals that would come in and eat these fruits, bringing seeds of other plants. So Milton planted a total of 12 species, and I worked with him in doing this labor of digging holes, putting trees into the holes, and caring for the seedlings as they emerged. I did the initial planting with him in 2008, and by the time I went back in 2014, these trees were towering up over my head, places that had been blasted, looking like concrete. These barren, windswept spaces had become this lively forest. And I went with the famed Costa Rican naturalist Eladio Cruz to count the unexpected emergences, the kinds of life, the species of plants that had come about into this assemblage of their own accord, that exceeded the dreams of Milton. This network he created of organisms was always enlisting others, always making making a world that could not just be inhabited by the self, but by a multitude of others that made it a more convivial place. So when I went back with Eladio, we found dozens of species just in a cursory day-long biodiversity survey of this place. So for me, Milton's project grounds hope in a more interesting way, I suppose, than the bombs, maybe a less ambivalent way, a way of grounding hope in the figures of actual living organisms that will flourish beyond the human. So we might think of wild emergences in the future that are exceeding our capacity to care, exceeding our capacity to manage. So for me, his work is a nice way of thinking, how we might create these spaces, how we might craft proposals to ones that we love, with the idea that they're going to go wild along unexpected lines of flight and invite others into the world with them.
Well, that's a perfect note to end on, I think. So, Eben, there's a ton of material now that we're wrapping up that we didn't have a chance to talk about. The book is exceptionally rich, and I hope listeners will go and find themselves a copy and read it themselves. But in the meantime, is there anything at all that we didn't have a chance to talk about but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
I'd just like to say a little bit about what I'm doing today. So here in Brooklyn, I'm working with a collective of artists. I have a team of five curators, and I've brought 50 artists together in this space in Brooklyn. And we're animating a lot of the themes in the book. The show is called Emergent Ecologies, and it opens later this month, April the 30th. We're going to have live performance art in this space. There's going to be endangered frogs and mutant fruit flies, as well as all sorts of artworks that are illuminating the different ways that both disasters are unfolding in environmental worlds all around us, but also pointing to surprising emergences that are hopeful, pointing to specific things here in New York City, specific kinds of plants that are very tenacious, good at living in a post-industrial landscape that has been blasted by humans, but also thinking about some problematic emergences in the context of biotechnology, thinking about ways that CRISPR-Cas9 and other gene editing softwares, epigenetically modified organisms that have been tweaked with tools of molecular biology are starting to run wild. So it's exploring the themes in the book, but also exceeding the book in many important ways, exploring lines of flight and arguments that I didn't have a chance to develop in the text, but in conversation with very talented artists that include Not an Alternative, a sort of refashioning of the Natural History Museum by some very interesting New York intellectuals, We've got Grayson Earl, the same digital media artist who worked with me on the Utopia for the Golden Frog. Krista Dragomer, a sound artist who's doing multimedia installations. A lot of really interesting stuff is going to be in the gallery. So the details are up on Facebook and online. The show starts April 30th and will be up for 3 weeks. And then we'll also have a Flash in the Pan event on June 18th. So it's in Brooklyn. The neighborhood is on the margins of Bed-Stuy and Clinton Hill near the Class M G train, for those who are familiar with New York City.
Great. And aside from that, is there anything else, aside from working on what sounds like a really fabulous exhibition, that you are working on right now that's inspiring you?
Yeah, so my new book project is exploring futures of the human species. So basically thinking about how tools, again, like CRISPR-Cas9, are enabling people to make their own evolutionary and ecological decisions. So the new book is being written at the moment, and with any luck, maybe it'll be a year or two before that one's out.
Wow. Well, best of luck with that. Slow down a little bit. Leave room for the rest of us to get some books out. But really, honestly, congratulations on a great book, Evan, and best of luck with all the things that you're doing, and especially good luck with the exhibition. Thanks for taking time away from that to talk with me today.
Thanks, Carla. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much for joining us today, and we'll catch you next time.